All right, we're going to get started. We are in Genesis chapter 47, the very end of that chapter. And somebody already asked me, how many more pages of notes do you have? And the answer is, you have them all. So we've got this week and next week, and we'll finish up with Genesis, long study, but we are approaching its end. And the book of Genesis does really end up tying itself off fairly nicely. We're going to see the death of Jacob and then the death of Joseph. And there is an element of great hope that is left at the end of this book about the hope of returning to the land of promise. And we'll talk a little bit about that probably next week, that element of hope. We'll see. Maybe we'll touch on it this week as well. But we're in Genesis chapter 47, beginning in verse 28. And we're, as I mentioned, getting into the section here at the end of the book where we have the death of Jacob and Joseph. The people of Jacob's sons have been settled in the land of Goshen. That's where they wanted to go. That allowed them to remain distinct as a people. And now they are approaching the end of their life. So we have, beginning of verse number 28, we have this statement that Jacob lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years. So that's a long time that he lived down there. And that would make his lifespan 147 years. And then we're going to learn a little bit about the last little bit of Jacob's life. The first section here refers in verses 28 through 31 to Joseph's promise to bury Jacob in Canaan. And this section is designed by Moses to move the reader to look beyond the patriarchs to Israel's time in Egypt and the settling of the land of promise. Now remember that Genesis does not stand alone as an isolated book. It's one of five that are designed to go together, the five scrolls, the Pentateuch. And you have here at the end of Genesis a transition that leads you into Exodus. And so the reader is being moved to the book of Exodus. And if you just didn't even have divisions and you kept reading, you would see in Genesis 50, the end of Genesis 50 to the beginning of Exodus, that the transition is very, very smooth, although they were on separate scrolls. So this section is moving us that direction. It's helping us to see that there's more to the story, that this movement of God that began in the Garden of Eden is not yet complete. Now, Jacob and Joseph meet. Jacob is an old man, very old man at this point. And in this section here, he asks Joseph in verse number 29 to place his hand under my thigh and give this promise. Now, that phrase "under my thigh" demonstrates the seriousness of this request. We've actually already seen this happen with Abraham and his servant when he sent the servant to go and get a wife for Isaac. So without trying to be too awkward here today, this is like putting your hand in very close to, or even potentially on, some commentators will say, a very intimate part of the body. So this wasn't done every day, and this was only done to show something that was extremely serious. Okay, so that's the reference there to what that means. Personally, I'm good with signing contracts. That works for me. But this was the thing in this day that was designed to show the severity or the seriousness of something. Hopefully that'll be the most awkward thing I say today, all right? But now you'll always know what that means, all right? So, but this was a serious request. And again, it was only done in very limited times in the ancient Near East for requests that were severe. So this shows that Jacob was really, really serious about this. Jacob's request was to be buried in the promised land. End of verse 29, "Do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt. Bury me in their burying place." And of course, Joseph said, "I'm going to do what you have said." Now, this request to be buried in the promised land, in that request, Jacob is not expressing mere sentimentalism. You know, it's not like, we've got the family plot, and I really want to be buried there, and it just would make everybody feel good. Actually, I think, and not just me, pretty much all Bible commentators see this as an act of worship. This is an act of worship. We read this in verse 31, "And he said, swear to me, and he swore to him. Then Israel bowed himself on the head of his bed." He bowed, or he leaned, some of your translations, on the head of his bed. This is an act of worship. Hold your place here in Genesis and go to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. The author of Hebrews references this account and also the blessing of the sons of Joseph, and he places it in Hebrews chapter 11 as, you know, what is commonly, that's commonly called, you know, the hall of faith, the Christian hall of faith, right? These are great people of faith. And he references Jacob as someone who demonstrates faith in this text. And he says, "By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship," or worshiped and leaning over the head or the top of his staff. Okay? Now, if you do a comparison from Hebrews 11 and the reference here to what Jacob does, and what we see in Genesis 47, you're going to note that some of the language is different, right? So in verse number 21 of Hebrews, it says bowing in worship, all right? That's not referenced there in the book of Genesis. And also you have the head of his staff instead of the head of his bed. So those are two different things. You might wonder, what is going on? This is a question that some Christians have asked, rightly so. The reason for the difference is that the word for bowed can be understood as an act of worship in the original Hebrew language. In addition, and so by the way, I think if you have a New American Standard, I'm not sure about the new LSB, I think the New American Standard says bowed and has in italics in worship. Does anybody have a NASB, a New American Standard? Is that correct? In Genesis, does it say in worship? Yeah. So those words in worship, are they in italics too? If I remember correct,
it looks like it.
Yeah. So they're doing that to make that point. So the New American Standard brings that idea out. But remember that in the New Testament author is usually quoted from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and that is known as the Septuagint, or you can see the abbreviation there, LXX. In the Greek New Testament, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the phrase is clearly bowed in worship. That's what the author of Hebrews quotes. And in addition, the word for bed and the word for staff in Hebrew uses the same consonants. Okay, so, you know, think about a word in your mind. All right, we're going to think about, you know, table. If we pulled out the vowels, you're going to have T-B-L. You don't have the A and the E. Now you say, why in the world would that make a difference? Well, actually, originally when Hebrew was written, the Hebrew that Moses wrote in, they did not actually use vowels at all. They just used the consonants. In fact, that makes it very difficult to read. I cannot read it because they would mash the words together and the consonants would be all together. It isn't till after the time of Christ that Hebrew scribes added what we call vowel pointing, to all the words to actually indicate what the vowels should be. So you think about some of our words in English, if we took out the vowels, we might have the same consonants. Well, in Hebrew, the word for bed and the word for staff have the same consonants. And so when the Greek translators of the Old Testament translated this word, they translated it as staff. Okay? So what that indicates is I think that that probably they got it right as the New Testament quotes this. The Old Testament that we have, the text, this is getting into the weeds, I know. The Old Testament text that we have is known as the Masoretic text. That occurs, that's produced many, many years after even the time of Christ where they added those vowel pointings in. So that's why the difference is there. But the author of Hebrews, I believe, rightly interprets this text as Jacob worshiping God. In his act is one of some of his final words of saying, I want to be buried where my forefathers were at, my fathers were at. He was indicating that he believed the promises of God. Those promises were given to Abraham, to Isaac, and they were reiterated to himself. And so you have this powerful picture. He's a very old man at this point. And he brings in Joseph, and he has this serious, solemn swearing of an oath that you will do this. And then whether it is on the head of his bed, or he gets up and leans against his staff, and he bows his head and worships God. So for all of Jacob's faults, we do see at the end of his life perseverance in the Lord. He was faithful. It's a powerful image of worship. So Joseph promises to bury Jacob in Canaan. And then we see a little more of Jacob. He not only is a man who worships, but we also see Jacob blessing Joseph's sons. And this occurs back in Genesis chapter 48. Comes to pass after these things, verse 1, Joseph is told, your father is sick. So he takes with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob is going to pronounce a special blessing upon Joseph's sons. Now, in general, this section here, it helps the reader to understand why there is no tribe of Joseph in the rest of the Pentateuch, but instead there is Ephraim and Manasseh. Maybe you've caught that before, but you read the Old Testament and you go through the 12 tribes and their allotments when you get to the end of the Pentateuch into Deuteronomy, and you realize Joseph never gets a land or a piece of land. Or you think about when you go to the map at the back of your Bible and it shows the territory of the people of Israel, or you Google one online where the various tribes were allotted, you're not going to find Joseph there. Why is that? This section explains this not only to us, but also to the people who are entering into the promised land. Now, this blessing, when it talks about Ephraim and Manasseh, occurred when these two men, they're not boys anymore, men, were in probably their 20s. So this is a long time after they've been born. Of course, Jacob's a very, very old man at this point, so this shouldn't surprise us. Now, this is important to understand what happens in this text. Number 3 there, Jacob adopted Joseph's two sons as his own, which granted them an equal share in the land of promise. So he's laying down, he's sick, he's nearly dead, he strengthens himself, he sits up on the bed. And he says this in verse number 5, and now your two sons, speaking to Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Okay? So they're going to be treated as if they were my sons. So they adopted him. Joseph, therefore, is going to receive a double blessing. Joseph is going to take the place of Reuben. in terms of the blessing that he receives. Further consequences include Ephraim and Manasseh being called by the name of Abraham and Isaac in verse 16, which meant that they would be considered the sons of Jacob, grandsons of Isaac, and great-grandsons of Abraham. And they were going to grow to be numerous in the land of promise. And in fact, if you read throughout the Old Testament, this is what happens. Ephraim and Manasseh become huge tribes of great power in the land of promise. Jacob also gives a special blessing to his newly adopted sons, but he gives a greater blessing to the younger Ephraim and not the older Manasseh. If you remember this account, this is where Joseph brings his two sons, so they're lined up perfectly, so Manasseh would be out for Jacob's right hand to place upon his head, and Ephraim, who was the younger of the boys, would have Jacob's left hand be placed upon their head. Both of them were going to receive blessing, but the older should always be on the right hand. And they walk up there, you know, he marches them up there, and you remember what Jacob does is he crosses his arms and gives the blessing, and Joseph's like, you know, Dad, yeah, I know you're getting old, but here, let me help you here, right? And he tries to push the hands back, and Jacob says, no, that's not the way it's going to be. The younger is going to be greater, which turned out to be true. Ephraim was a powerful, powerful tribe. In fact, if I remember correctly, for the northern kingdom, when eventually they're split, it's frequently referred to as Ephraim, right? In the Old Testament, am I thinking right on that? Okay, so that's just because they came to dominate so much of Israel's life. So Jacob gives this a special blessing. Therefore, Jacob here functions as a prophet. There's your blanks there for number four. He functions as a prophet, which prepares the reader for the prophetic statements regarding his other sons in the next chapter. Now, 1 Chronicles 5, verses 1 through 2, gives the reason why Joseph's sons received a double blessing. In fact, I'll just read it. It's explicitly clear. The sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's couch or his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that he could not be enrolled as the oldest son, though Judah became strong among his brothers, and a chief came from him. Yet the birthright belonged to Joseph. So remember the account there that Reuben slept with his father's concubine, and Jacob had heard about that, and he did not forget. And so before he died, he ensured that the inheritance that would normally, the oldest son would receive a double portion of the inheritance that was not given to Reuben, but instead was given to someone else. So this is a pretty serious consequence for his action. Now, with the addition of the two sons of Joseph, the number of tribal allotments should be 13. So there's 12 sons, right? We've got Reuben all the way down to Benjamin. Don't ask me to name them all in order, all right? But you've got 12 sons there, Reuben down to Benjamin. Now you've taken away Joseph, but you've added two more, Ephraim and Manasseh. You should have 13 tribes. However, what we find later in the Pentateuch is that Simeon is subsumed under Judah. If you go all the way to the end of the Pentateuch, end of book of Deuteronomy, there in Deuteronomy 33, Moses gives a blessing to the people of Israel just before they're about to cross into the promised land. Moses does not mention Simeon, who was the second born. Rather, Judah is mentioned second in order, which should have been Simeon's place. Moses grants Levi status as a tribe, however, he would not receive land. You remember that Simeon and Levi were the ones who committed the sin of slaughtering the men at Shechem. And so that sin had enduring consequences. Enduring consequences. Is that making sense, by the way, to you? That's how we get to the 12 tribes when you see that map at the back of your Bible. You're not going to find a slot for Simeon.
So, you know, he skipped all the other sons. I mean, they gave an account why the oldest wasn't chosen, but he skipped all the other sons. Is there, you know, is it because of what they did to Joseph? Or...
Well, we're going to get the next chapter that he does bless them all.
Mm-hmm.
But he is explaining, you're saying why they didn't just get bumped up in order. My assumption and most Bible commentators' assumption is that the reason why he went down to Joseph is because, yes, all of the other sons sinned in throwing Joseph into the pit. But also, there's a secondary thing, is that Joseph was the eldest born of Rachel. And that may factor into this as well. That could be seen as still his favoritism playing there, but it also could be that, you know, whereas the others were concubines, some came from concubines. There were older sons, firstborn from other concubines. The actual wife of Jacob, Rachel, Joseph would have been the oldest.
Just three questions of speculation, which I don't know if you want to go there, but do you think Jacob crossed his hands to kind of redo what happened to Esau and Jacob, how that switched? Have you ever read anything like that? And the second question is, Jacob says, these two sons are mine, and anything else is yours. So is there anyone that writes that Joseph had other sons?
Sure.
And the third speculation is, from last week, why did Joseph make it so all the land went to Pharaoh? Is there any reasoning that you ever read on those?
So as to the first, I don't know that we can answer the question directly about why he did crossing his hands, other than I do think that you see that Jacob has been given by God prophetic insight. Because we're going to see that explicitly when he blesses his other sons, because he's going to say, gather you together and I'm going to tell you what happens in the last days or the latter days. So, but broadly speaking, there is a theme that has developed throughout Genesis where the oldest doesn't always get the best. Because you think about Cain and Abel, that didn't work out. And you also think about Jacob and Esau as well. But you even think about Isaac and Ishmael. So there's a consistent theme. And I think one of the theological points and practically is that God doesn't work according to our timetable, and he doesn't work according to our way of thinking. His ways are above. So all the culture would have said the oldest, the oldest, the oldest, the oldest. But God doesn't operate by those rules. So I would think more along those lines, that Jacob is functioning prophetically here. I do think, though, that he makes it really, really clear, you know, what's happening. And there is definitely a link between himself blessing those two sons and also the blessing that he received from Isaac. But I don't know if he's trying to undo anything, because it obviously bothered Joseph. Your second question was, your third question was about Pharaoh and the grain.
Joseph had other sons.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, it says, because he said, Jacob says, the other sons after are yours.
Yeah.
In the context.
Yeah, I'm sure they did, but I don't know the genealogies and chronicles well enough to know if they pick that up. Does anybody know? Do they identify the sons?
Well, I don't know that they did. I mean, is there any hint or any commentaries you...
I probably have, but I don't remember. The third thing with Joseph making Pharaoh rich, I think and possessing all the land, that sets us up for what's going to happen 400 years later, or not quite 400 years at this point, but when the people of Israel are going to leave the land of Egypt. Pharaoh becomes incredibly powerful through this. Was it right and good what Joseph did in even collecting all the land of the Egyptians unto himself so that Pharaoh would gain all that power? I don't know. The Egyptians were happy. That's what the text records. They lived. Yeah.
God ordains leadership of countries. And so, in one sense, yes, it is a good thing. If it goes bad, that's due to the error of Pharaoh and moving down different ways. And there's no sign that this Pharaoh was ever bad to people or anything else. Subsequent Pharaohs certainly were.
Yeah. In general, I don't think you want to take what happens with Joseph's collecting all that for Pharaoh as a model for how society should operate in regards to private property. I think it's a pointer to say, now you know why that hundreds of years later, when the people of Israel are ready to leave, that Pharaoh wields so much power. You know, descendants from him. Private property is established well as a right in the rest of the Pentateuch, I think.
What's interesting, though, is that the people actually do pay for their own sustenance here, so it's not a welfare system. So, I mean, there's like a give and a take here that are kind of interesting, but again, they rest upon the honesty, integrity of the leader.
Yeah.
Would that also help with dating that particular time frame as well, because you see Egypt going from more of a regional controlled government to, under Joseph, centralizing all of the power under the Pharaoh. I think there are one, if not two, points in Egypt's history where you actually see a massive shift from funding control go from the regional governors to more of a centralized control under Pharaoh.
The answer is yes. I do think this helps us date the book of Exodus, or book of Genesis, and or this time period, I should say, specifically. But to be fair, some of that is a little bit murky because you're dealing with stuff here that's roughly around 1800 BC. So that's a long time ago. Our records are scant. I don't know about you, but I lose stuff weekly. So, all right. But I do think there is a point to be made there, which would be a lot broader than this study can go. In general, the reason why David's question is actually very important is because there are two dates that are proposed for the people of Israel leaving the land of Egypt to the promised land. There's an early date and there's a latter date. Many Bible teachers, including ones that I would say are generally conservative, think about a latter date. And the problem is, if you hold to that, it throws off the timetable of David's reign as king. There's a bunch of things that go haywire in there. And they try to work with that. I would be thinking of a much earlier date, which puts the Exodus around 1400 BC. Rewind the clock, that puts Abraham around 1800 BC in that range. Those are just rounding the numbers. But that question actually is important because there are records that would indicate what David was saying as a collection of power under certain time periods in the reign of the pharaohs. All right, let's get to the blessing. Jacob's final blessing for his sons. So you come to chapter number 50, or 49, excuse me. Jacob is going to bless all of his sons. So just note a couple of general comments here. The blessings that Jacob offers to his sons not only recount what some of the sons had accomplished, but also what they would accomplish in the future. So Jacob prophesies about the future of his sons. Moses, I mentioned this earlier, makes this clear when he speaks about what will happen to you in the last days, or ESV, days to come. I actually think the translation last days here is better. That's a very precise term that is used in the Old Testament, and when it is used, it is always used in a prophetic context. So the people of Israel reading this would have thought immediately about prophecy. Second, just general comment, Jacob gives this blessing in the form of a poem. And if you've got a modern translation, you're going to see that the typeset is offset, it's centered or in italics in verses 2 and following, something like that. And that's an indication that it is Hebrew poetry. Now, third, a general comment, Moses' blessings of the 12 tribes before his death, and I referenced that earlier, that's in Deuteronomy 33, Moses' blessings of the blessing of the 12 tribes before his death finds a parallel here in Genesis 49 with Jacob's blessings of his sons right before Jacob's death. That's an interesting study in and of itself, and you'll find a lot of helpful parallels between the two. So the end of Genesis, Jacob blesses. The end of Deuteronomy, which is the end of the Pentateuch, Moses blesses the 12 tribes. That's another just small indication. You remember way back when we talked about how some people think that the Pentateuch is kind of a composite editorial thing where they mishmashed a bunch of documents together. There's just the more you read through that, the more that just seems ridiculous. There's clear literary parallels all throughout the five scrolls. Another interesting thing to note is that nearly half of the prophecy is dedicated to Judah and Joseph. And in the text that we read in 1 Chronicles 5, where it talks about Reuben giving up his right, or the birthright, and being replaced with Joseph, even the author of Chronicles notes, as he gives his genealogy, that yes, Joseph was given the double blessing for his two sons there, but he also makes clear that Judah was where the chief, the king, was going to come from. So they recognize that as well. And finally, the poetic prophecy includes animal imagery. And I think actually the animals are used in a positive way to describe the sons of Jacob. Now we say blessing, and I should note this as well. It's not quite a blessing for Reuben and Simeon and Levi, the first three. And just read through this. It's kind of tragic. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the firstfruits of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power, unstable as water. You shall not have preeminence because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. So that was his blessing. You're known as unstable as water. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Yes, of course, they're biologically brothers, but Jacob is using this poetically. They're brothers in that their weapons of violence are their swords. Let not my soul come into their counsel. O my glory, be not joined to their company, for in their anger they killed men, and in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. That's probably a poetic image of talking about them, the slaughter of the people of Shechem. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And that's exactly what happened to them. Now, in terms of the prophecy itself, Reuben, the firstborn, would lose his preeminence because he slept with Bilhah. We already just read this, Simeon and Levi, since they massacred the inhabitants of Shechem without their father's knowledge, will be scattered in the land. Judah takes the place of Reuben, And he will reign, it says, until the coming of Shiloh. Verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until tribute comes to him, or until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. This particular prophecy is significant because it references the coming of the Messiah. The image of the lion is associated with this tribe, and Jesus Christ is the lion of the tribe of Judah. Revelation 5:5. In verse number 10, the image of the scepter demonstrates rule and authority. The promise is that all the rest of the tribes would bow down before him, which indicates that kings would come from his line. Now, the phrase, until Shiloh comes, and that's found in verse 10, it's translated in the ESV, until tribute comes to him, is a very difficult phrase to translate. For my own part, I think it likely means until he comes to whom it belongs, or until he possesses what belongs to him. But good Bible teachers have differing opinions on this. What everybody agrees, though, on is that this is a reference to the Messiah. For my own part, I think if you compare Ezekiel 21, 25 through 27 and this text, that you get the idea of until it comes to whom it belongs, or until it possesses who but what belongs to him, is that this is a reference to there will come a day in which a descendant of Judah will possess all the authority. You have a similar idea the way the ESV translates it when it says until tribute comes to him. That's possible grammatically. The idea is you think about a powerful king that all the nations of the earth are paying tribute to. It still gets the same idea across, although I think the possession language is probably more likely. Still, there are some others, as the New King James translates it. I'm not sure. I can't remember the New American Standard. Is it Shiloh? Does it say Shiloh in that as well? Is that correct? Okay. The vocalization here could be a place name. However, that is difficult to understand at this point because Shiloh is destroyed. We actually see that in 1 Samuel. And we've actually preached to that. It's never rebuilt. But some people would say this is a reference to a rebuilding of Shiloh as a place that would demonstrate the glory of the Lord. So those are some of the options there. But like I said, everybody agrees that this is a promise of the Messiah. In fact, if you were to go to Jewish teachers, even before the time of Christ, they would have said this is a messianic promise. So they all see this is a promise of Messiah. The extent of this rule will be to the obedience of the peoples, verse 10. And the New King James unfortunately translates this as singular here. It is not singular. It is plural, peoples. All the nations will be brought under the authority of the King, the Messiah, King Jesus, as we would say today. So this prophecy gives more information as the promise that all nations would be blessed through Abraham. Through Abraham, that's your blank there at the end of 4. And then we'll stop here with this, finish up this prophecy section. The imagery in verses 11 and 12 depicts riches during the Messiah's reign. Normally, no one would tie a donkey to a grapevine because the donkey would eat all the grapes and vines, which were luxury items. And I've never had a donkey, but I've been told that they eat pretty much everything. Just chomp, 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 away they go, all right? And so grapes are expensive to raise. You don't want to let your donkey near those. Put them near the weeds. Put them out in the pasture that you don't care about. Don't ever let them near the vines. The fact that there was this kind of Wealth and prosperity indicate something about what will happen when the Messiah reigns. Similarly, washing clothes in wine indicates luxury. You would never do that. Wine was far too expensive. So in this day, wealth will abound when the Messiah comes to reign. No one will be lacking or wanting. All right, we've got to stop there. I'm a few minutes over time, and we'll get ready for our morning worship service and look forward to next week to wrapping up our time in Genesis.